This is Gail Carriger, and you are listening to the SF Signal Podcast.
This is the SF Signal Podcast, episode number 25, as powered by the Functional Nerds. My name is Patrick Hester. I'm an author, a blogger, and an all-around functional nerd, no matter what Ottinger says. And I only say that when he's on the show now. You may have noticed that. And tonight I'm joined by a bunch of people. Let's start off with Mr. John Ottinger, since I just mentioned you.
Greetings.
Greetings. How is it in the wild, wild east?
It's late at night.
So you're just not in the mood to joke?
No, all's well, all's well. Things are great out this way. So.
Gotcha. And then second, we have Lisa.
Hello.
When's your book coming out?
Comes out March 28th.
I'm going to ask you that every single time.
Thank you.
Returning from a very long absence where he gorged himself on bagels and lox, Mr. John DiNardo.
Bagels. How you doing, folks?
And once again, in the center square, we have Mr. Jeff Patterson.
What's with the snow? Every 4 days, it's snowing. I'm sick of this.
Yeah, it snowed. It took me 1 hour to get home tonight.
Not to rub it in, it's 70 degrees down here in Florida.
Please. If it snowed in Florida, you wouldn't know what to do.
It snows on the beach occasionally, at least once a year. It doesn't stick, but it does snow.
You know what? You're responsible for CSI Miami, so I don't even want to hear it. Hold on, I got to take my glasses off dramatically. Tonight we are talking not about Hollywood or CSI. We're talking about Huckleberry Finn. Should books with controversial or offensive content be changed to make them more palatable to the public? A revised version of Huckleberry Finn will be released next month that replaces all 219 instances of the racially charged N-word with the word slave. Is this acceptable? Who gets to decide what is and isn't offensive? And are we standing on the precipice of a slippery slope where the freedom of speech is trumped by public sentiment? I also have wonder, why is the N-word offensive, but slave is not? So it's okay to own people, apparently, in this revised edition. Mr. Ottinger, why don't you go? What do you think?
Well, obviously, I mean, I fall on the side of not changing it whatsoever. I think that the issue, I mean, it's been done before where things like that have been removed. I think the issue is that this is a critical scholar publishing this book and saying that this needs to be done. And I think that has caused more uproar than anything, because there's many abridged editions and things of that nature where the word is taken out because a third or fourth grader is about to pick it up because it's abridged. And it's just not there because they can't handle it. But obviously, in a high school level, they certainly could. So, you know, I think that ultimately, you know, as this particular edition, since it's so close to the original, it's not abridged in any way, it's just going too far.
Yeah, is it similar to erasing history? I mean, it's almost like by changing this, they're going to give these readers, the people who read this book, the wrong impression. I mean, that is not how life was lived back then, and isn't kind of the point of this to show us this is how life was, and gosh, isn't that terrible and wrong, and we must remember our past and not repeat it?
I think history is true, but I think the thing that actually destroys is Twain's particular provocateur sort of mindset. I mean, at the time he was writing this and many of his later works, his whole goal was to just push on people's brains and see what would come out. And I think that changing the word, that's what it removes the sense in which Twain wrote it. I don't think that it in any way changes the historical fact of slavery or anything like that, because he did change the word from the N-word to slave. So the meaning is still there, though maybe not with the same amount of strength, let's say.
John DiNardo, science fiction is particularly well known for trying to investigate and kind of bring to light topics and subjects that might otherwise not be discussed. I think that's a good way to put it. Do you think there are some science fiction novels out there that it should be changed or abridged to make them more palatable?
I think not. I'm against changing text, especially like John said, at this level, at the level of the intended audience. It's not portraying the work in the form it was written in. It does, like you said, it stands as in some respects as a historical document. I don't think change. You know, is it your question was, is it acceptable? I don't know if it's acceptable, but I don't think it's necessary. I didn't think there was any reason to change it. As far as science fiction texts, I there's a list somewhere of banned science fiction novels. I mean, Fahrenheit 451, I guess, was one of those. I don't see any. I can't think of any really offensive science fiction novels.
Shades Garden or Shades, except maybe Shades Children by Garth Nix. 1984 by George Orwell was banned. Fahrenheit 451 was banned. A Wrinkle in Time was banned.
Yeah, books that are usually generally considered classics. A lot of those, right? Mm-hmm. I mean,
the thinking behind changing Huckleberry Finn is that if we change it and make it less offensive, that will open it up to audiences and they'll read it. So should we change 1984 to make it, should we do the Hollywood thing? Should we make it PG-13 and do a Burger King tie-in?
I think no.
What about you, Lisa?
I don't think it should be changed. I mean, like you said, that Twain, for the most part, was always trying to push people's buttons. And when this book came out, he was specifically criticizing racism. And I think to change the term dilutes his point. And people have been talking about banning this book ever since it was published.
Well, what about the idea of going through and just, their argument again is that by changing it, they make it more open and acceptable and easier for people to read. And therefore, their argument is also that, by doing this, more people will read the book. Is that a good thing?
I see the point about possibly abridging certain novels to reach a younger audience. But at the same time, I also think that not every novel is meant to be read by a third grader or a fourth grader, because there are complex issues being examined and that you need a little bit more maturity to understand them. But so generally, I'm not really all that for changing something like this.
I kind of liken this to All in the Family. When I was very young and I watched All in the Family, and I knew I grew up on the Brady Bunch, right? So, I knew stereotyping was bad and racism was bad and all that stuff. I'd watched All in the Family and listened to their laugh track or whatever, or the audience laughter and all that stuff. And I just didn't find it funny. I found it offensive as a child. I saw it later when I kind of understood that what they were doing is making social commentary on racism. And I saw Archie Bunker for the idiot he was. And, I don't know that I found it funny, but, at least I understood what they were trying to do when I was older. But I don't wish that, they had cleaned it up for when I was younger. That's just silly.
There are so many books out there, so many classics to choose from that will work for younger readers, and could easily be used to work up to a novel like this when they're mature enough to understand the issues that are being examined in it.
Well, even in Twain's case, Tom Sawyer is a much cleaner, quote-unquote, book that a much younger child could read, whereas Huck Finn was addressing issues that, you're pushing into middle school and high school at that point.
Jeff, you're being awful quiet. What do you think?
I'm certain Twain would have no problem with his text being altered whatsoever. A couple things are coming to mind. Number one, when you're talking about slippery slope, you know, first thing that's coming to mind, rather obviously, sadly enough, is the you know, stuff like Kindred by Octavia Butler and the Nail Hopkinson books and stuff like that, where we're dealing with very similar situations wherein the point of the book would really be lost if they were sanitized in such a way. Number one. Number two, I'm reminded of, there was a minor scandal in the late 70s, and I do not remember exactly what book it was, about when Reader's Digest was doing the condensed books volumes that they used to mail out to people, and there were a number of books that were considered to be overly sanitized. And it was sort of a blip on the radar, and it went away because it wasn't, you know, these were the condensed books that went out to the subscribers. They weren't the, you know, the legitimate editions that were on the stands at the time. This is a book that's always had issues because it's something that they've wanted to teach in high schools. And I'm more than willing to bet that somewhere this guy's got a nice, really big, lucrative high school contract, you know, for supplying additions to schools so they can put it back in their curriculums again. But, you know, I mean, most of what's going on here and most of what the debate has been on this thing has sort of been, you know, pigeonholing it into strictly being sanitizing or not sanitizing it, when in fact it's a bit broader than that. It comes down to, look, this is a book that somebody can go in and tweak with impunity. You know, it effectively constitutes a remix, which is something that's been a big debate when it comes to copyright and stuff like that lately. And when it finally comes home, people start realizing, oh my God, now it constitutes censorship and stuff like that. The original book is always going to be there. You can find, you know, the used bookstores are chock full of it. It's probably on, you know, millions and millions of shelves as it is. And I think this is probably, again, going to be a blip on the radar.
Well, imagine for a second, you know, let's say that this is a high school thing. Let's say that this is to get it back in the curriculum. And some kid somewhere, you know, reads it and thinks, oh, this is a great book, you know. And then they go out and buy it, and suddenly they're shocked because it's different.
Well, then it's somewhere a teacher's not doing their job.
Well, actually, as a professional educator, let me speak to that.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, there you go, right? Don't get me started. Now I'm on my hot horse. But the issue that I've seen in the debate has not been the student having a problem with the book itself. It's usually the preface of the teacher that makes them uncomfortable. Because the teacher doesn't know how to handle, theoretically anyway, doesn't know how to handle addressing this use of the word, and it becomes, or they don't address it at all, and becomes this sort of sniggering thing behind the back that the teacher doesn't always pick up on.
Right. Here's one for you guys. Is this a symptom of a greater political correctness problem that we're having, Lisa?
I don't know about political correctness. I think it might be a sign that we're unwilling to examine anything in context. We seem to, you know, the whole 24-hour news cycle, to get in on that without any context. And you shouldn't be teaching this book without providing a context for it and discussing the issues that Twain was trying to criticize when he wrote it.
Well, and this also comes, you talk about the news cycle, this comes when Twain's autobiography is finally being released.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's the fact that he's back in the news again.
I'm certain that falls into play somewhere. Like I said, this is definitely a board news cycle that bases its headlines and what it's going to cover. More on outrage and comments that are going to be posted on the website, as opposed to being actual news. I'm not trying to minimize the impact of the fact that, you know, this edition is being released. But how widespread is this issue going to, you know, go? I'm certain that it's probably going to sell more copies now that it's been a news story than it would have otherwise.
I'm bothered by the fact that a classic American book is being changed. I really am. It bothers me. I don't like it. I think that's coming across.
Patrick, let me ask you a question.
Sure.
To shift the things a little bit, are there books where the book would be stronger for such a sanitization? Let's say there's some throwing in of some uses of the word that are completely egregious and are not helpful at all. I mean, especially in science fiction, if anybody can think of any. I was trying to think of some before the podcast today. Nothing came to mind directly, but there's probably stuff out there.
I guess I don't get the point. I'm against, you know, it's, we have to stop George Lucas.
We just got to wait till 2012. He'll be gone.
I'm thinking more of the guns that were removed from E.T. That seems more of a...
There you go. I mean, there's a great point. You know, the guns were removed from E.T. because of, you know, Spielberg. Lucas wanted to change Star Wars. Now we're going to change Huckleberry Finn. Are we going to... Here's one. Are we going to... The same word used in, like, Spike Jonze movies. So are we going to go back and edit those movies and change them?
Oh, I'm not arguing for it. I'm just wondering if there are things that would actually be better as a result of such a sanitization. Well,
then you go back to the other part of the question is who gets to decide what is and isn't better?
Well, I mean, in the case of better? Lucas, like you say, that's his intellectual property. He can do that if he wants to.
Okay. So, but what if, you know, Lucas
so
dies?
So the author has the right, no question.
What if Lucas dies in 2012 as he's expecting to die? If no one read that, go to the internet. He dies in 2012 and his daughter decides now that she owns the copyright, oh my gosh, you know, I want to change it again. And now Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon are going to be lovers because I think that's going to be better.
That would be awesome.
And now, you know,
that would make so much for a better movie.
And for those of you out there listening to this, send the links to the slash fic to Jeff Patterson at. The whole point of it is where do you draw the line? So, John, you feel that the author is more than in their own rights to change their own works. I guess I'm just saying, where do you draw the line?
Well,
you know,
can I jump in here real quick?
Sure.
I mean, a very similar parallel has existed for years when it comes to movies being shown on broadcast television, or even something like the fact that A&E shows The Sopranos.
They hack them up.
To the point where when movies are made, they actually have the actors record the lines that they're going to use to insert
yes.
over them, like they do with Big Lebowski and like they do with... Kill Bill and
anything with Bruce Willis.
Pulp Fiction and,
yeah, anything yes. with Bruce Willis.
Yeah, any along those lines. That has been a reality for decades now. It's been an accepted reality, and so nobody complains about it. They go and they watch the DVD or they watch it when it comes up on cable.
Do you think those films are trying to make some broad social comment? Because I think that Twain was trying to do that. He chose to write this book in a very deliberate way, I think.
I would say no to that. However, I would say that this does, you know, in the case of something like Sopranos, the way it airs on A&E, especially in the later seasons where they were talking about terrorism and Arabs and stuff like that, I would say, yeah, possibly it was. To a smaller extent, but I think it was there.
Well, this is definitely a heavier topic than we normally talk about.
I know. You got to throw us a lob ball here.
I threw the George Lucas thing in. Come on.
I tried to bring up E.T. Come on.
You did, yes. But you didn't bring enough Reese's Pieces for everyone.
Did not. Remember, Han shot first.
Yes, Han shot first. Yeah. Don't even get me started. All right, well, I think we're going to call this one done. It seems like everybody kind of agrees that, you know, maybe this isn't a great thing. Ottinger, do I get that from you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So, you know, I don't think that we've necessarily need to come to a conclusion on this topic. It's just something that I wanted to throw out there and have everybody kind of talk about. And if people weren't aware of it, kind of wanted to make them aware of it. So thanks, everyone, for coming on. Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you.
Thank you, John Ottinger.
Thank you.
Thank you, John DiNardo.
No, thank you.
And thank you, Mr. Jeff Patterson in the Center Square.
You don't thank me enough.
I know. And tonight, John DiNardo and myself are joined by science fiction author S. Andrew Swan. Say hello.
Hello.
And he is the author of over 21 novels under various different names. Why don't you go ahead and list some of those names for folks so they know how to find your stuff?
Primarily it's S. Andrew Swan. That's the vast majority of the stuff.
Okay.
There's five other books that are under other names. Two vampire novels that are under my given name, which is S. A. Swinyarski, in case anybody's wondering, the S stands for Steve. And the other three, while I like the books, they are out of print and the rights have reverted, and I've decided that I am going to kill and bury the author.
Understood.
It's like this is the one I got in a situation where I was attempting to shift genres, which I do way too often, and my editor wanted another name, and I made the bad decision of letting them pick one, and it ended up being Stephen Crane with a K. And there was some sort of rationalization about alphabetizing between King and Koontz,
right,
because it was doing the thriller thing. But I've never really been able to live that down. When the rights finally reverted to those three books, I actually posted an obituary on my blog for. So if those books ever do see print, they're probably going to be seeing print under S. Andrew Swan.
There you go.
Which is. Or S.A. Swan, or some variant thereof.
Well, I know that DiNardo at least just only wants to talk about the Apotheosis trilogy.
Well, that was my introduction to your work. Well, it was my introduction to reading your work. I actually bought some of your Moreau novels in a as I tend to accumulate a lot of books and way faster than I can read them. So I have some of the.
I've been there, done that.
Yeah. So I have some of the Moreau.
I'm in danger of being buried under a collapsing to be read pile myself.
Well, and I was just gonna say real quick, John, we're kind of getting a little bit ahead of ourselves. Why don't we, for the sake of the listeners who have no idea what we're talking about, the three of us are really old friends. We had lunch once at World Fantasy, but. Why don't you tell our listeners just a little bit about who you are and you know, your books and what you do?
I tend to write in all sorts of genres. I started writing professionally with my first sale was back in 1993, which was the first of those Moreau novels that John was talking about, and I wrote a trilogy in that universe, which was near future science fiction that was pretty much noir, genetic engineering run rampant in a somewhat dystopian universe after a really, really big world war had sort of collapsed a bunch of the social order.
Okay.
And I went from there to space opera, Hostile Takeover, which I decided, and probably one of the most serendipitous decisions I've made in my writing career, that about halfway through writing the first book of Hostile Takeover, I decided, wouldn't it be neat if I connected that to the first trilogy? And it just sort of blossomed from there. And that Hostile Takeover was a second trilogy, which was finished in the mid-90s, thereabouts, and the Apotheosis one, which we've been talking about, which are my next book, which is the last book of that trilogy, comes out in the 1st of February, and that is sort of a direct continuation of that universe, albeit it's not like a really immediate successor, because it's set about 250 years on from the Hostile Takeover series, which itself was set about 200 some years after the Moreau books I wrote. So they throw in another book in there that I wrote in the late 90s. There's about 10 books in the series.
Wow.
Most of which can be read independently of each other.
Wow.
And that's about half my output. The other half of my output is all over the map. I've written historical novels, vampire novels, straight up horror. I've written urban fantasy before urban fantasy was cool. I wrote a book called two books called The Dragons of the Cuyahoga and Door of the Whiskey Island, which are sort of in the same vein as the Dresden books. You know, the premise being, during a playoff game between the Browns and the Steelers, a portal to another universe opens up on the Steelers' 5-yard line, and you know, dragons and elves and dwarves come out and basically wreak havoc. And I write about a political reporter who's like covers the death of a supposedly immortal dragon by crash landing in the Cuyahoga River. That's the title of the book.
The sad part of that story is that in that game between the Browns and the Steelers, that was the most exciting moment.
Not only that, I do mention the fact that, you know, it's like when they finished the quarter back in Pittsburgh, Browns lost. There's a certain amount of pessimism when you're a Clevelander when it comes to professional sports teams.
Yes.
I think there's some karmic rule that we can only have one professional sports franchise in this town at any one time that doesn't suck. And it's like the Browns only had a chance to have the season they've had is because we lost LeBron James, basically.
Hey, but maybe you'll pick up Josh McDaniels as like a football coach. I'm really, really making a lot of people go, what? Huh? What are they talking about? Anyway, let's get back on the science fiction, because I know that's what John wants to talk about. So, John loves this Apotheosis trilogy, and it's all he can talk about.
I do tend to mention it a lot. because the subject comes up, the good things that you read in 2010 or whatever, yep. And that was one of my best reads. Absolutely.
I certainly appreciate that. I will say, however, I'm beginning to feel a little pressure for the third book, because it's like I'm starting to think, what if John doesn't like it?
You know, I think about that often. You know, I think about expectations often about how I build it up so much in my mind, and that it's like, you know, there's no way it could possibly meet my expectations. Same thing with movies. You know, I should go in with low expectations. That way I'll be pleasantly surprised with any book or movie. That's just the way I should do it. It's the way I should approach a work. Before we talk about that, though, you mentioned, so half your output was in this Moreau universe, and the other half like is all over the genre map. Why do you write in different genres? Not many writers do.
I don't know. I just happen to be very eclectic in my tastes. People tend to, I think authors tend to gravitate toward what they enjoy to read. And I just happen to enjoy a lot of different things. So I, In a lot of cases, I gravitate toward what I happen to be interested in at the time. And I also had the benefit of having a rather long and fairly productive relationship with Daw Books. It got to the point, it's like six books in, that you know, I was sort of reliable enough both in terms of providing them you know, books on some reasonable schedule that they can expect, and also in having relatively steady sales, even though I sort of bounced around a bit, that I was sort of given a bit of free rein for a long portion of my career. So I was able to go and do things like make an attempt at a contemporary thriller, which Zimmerman's Algorithm, which I think is probably, if you had me to pick the least of my works, I would probably kick that one to the curb.
I imagine that keeps writing fresh, though, for you.
Yes, it does. I mean, just the past couple of years, when I was writing the Apotheosis Trilogy, I was swapping between those books and alternating with my medieval werewolf fantasy series, which you can imagine there's quite a bit of difference between, you know, going from, you know, faster than light travel, you know, multiple planets, you know, lasers, plasma rifles, and then going to like the Balkans and the Teutonic Knights.
Yeah, but you got to mash those together. Give the werewolves lasers.
Freaking lasers on their heads. So the idea to continue, you know, to do the Apotheosis Trilogy, was why return to that universe?
For a while ago, I wrote a little piece for Scalzi's blog for his big idea where I went into this. But the basic upshot of it is, while I wrote Hostile Takeover and I had this sort of something I'm prone to do, which is set up this elaborate world-building universe and then proceed to destroy it bit by bit over the course of a novel.
Which is fun.
By the end, there's nothing particularly left.
Right.
So I went through that whole arc. So, you know, all the major characters had their plot lines resolved, and, you know, all the major plot threads were tied up. But there were some threads left dangling. Not necessarily plot threads, but just threads in the world, and that, okay, I sort of deconstructed this entire social structure I'd set up. So, you know, something's got to fill the vacuum. And there are two ideas in particular which prompted me to write this book that were left hanging. One is one of the central conceits of the Hostile Takeover universe is the fact that humanity basically kept creeping up toward the singularity and getting smacked in the face, so that there were built up these social taboos around three technologies specifically: artificial intelligence, bioengineering of sentience, and self-replicating nanotechnology. And when I was writing Hostile Takeover, that was sort of just an authorial dodge, because I wanted to write the sort of like classic space opera type stuff that I read as a teenager, you know, the stuff, you know, from Niven, Paul Anderson, and Mac Reynolds, and, you know, those sorts of guys, without the whole, you know, Vinge singularity thing staring me in the face, and I have to deal with all that weirdness. And that's not the story I wanted to write at the time. So, okay, well, I'll put some social taboos on it. It worked for China for 1,000 years. Why don't they work for here? So I did that without actually thinking about the ramifications beyond that series. But after I left that series, it's like, okay, I broke down the social orders. What happens to those taboos? And so I got thinking about, okay, I sort of opened the door a crack for that singularity thing to start creeping into this universe. What's going to happen? The other piece of it, which really you don't see at all in the first two books, it's pretty much only present in the last book, and I'll leave it at that to, you know, avoid giving any spoilers. But one of the other tropes I have in that book, Hostile Takeover, which I refer to again and again, and as a matter of fact is a major plot point, is the fact that we have this, you know, this ancient stellar civilization that sort of left these terraformed planets about with these, you know, artifacts on them. And I never really answered who these, you know, ancients were and what they were doing and why they were doing it. So there was that question left hanging. Mm. And again, that was another situation where it was, you know, sort of like, you know, authorial hocus pocus. It's like I brought those ancients in for sort of plot reasons and wrote them into the narrative. You know, once I concluded the plot, it's like their role in it was over, such as it was. But that left it sort of hanging, and, you know, it's like, so I had two major unanswered questions. The first one.
Who were they and where did they come from?
Pretty much throughout the entire book.
Yeah.
Entire Apotheosis series. The latter one, that's where you can see it sort of leading up to in the first two books, but I'm answering that particular plot thread in the last one.
John, are you salivating?
I'm thinking back to the books, and it struck me that you know, reading it, they really came across as being very well crafted, very very meticulously mapped, and to its benefit, I might add, you know, very 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 meticulously mapped and planned out and timelined and the whole thing, you know, with the plot threads interweaving and things like that, and it just when you're reading it, you just feel like you're in very capable hands. So it was a very thrilling read. It was very, you know, I felt like the story was never out of control. And that all the elements really played in well together.
Yeah. You were telling me, I mean, when you were really truly gushing about it, you were saying that it was very well paced, and I think the phrase that you used that caught me was you said that it was satisfying your need for space opera or something like that.
Yeah, my space opera Jones.
Yeah,
yeah, and it was a really what did I say? It was a really good. It was like a perfect blend of like all these different elements, right? It was, you know, like the political intrigue, right? There was the space opera adventure stuff. You know, there was mystery, religion, world building. It was just a perfect combination. There was never any point where it was just perfectly balanced. There was never a point where you said, okay, all right, get on with it already. It's not enough info dumping. There was never that. It was just very well, it was just perfectly paced. It was very, very well done. So I kind of picture that you have, you know, like some serial killer almost, have some of these pages all over your walls.
Not quite. I mean, some of that is actually due to the fact that I'm basically been building on this universe, you know, for 17 years. So, it you know, the fact is I don't need notes for most of the backstory. I mean, what I did for a lot of the notes in this book, a lot of the, you know, little details you're reading about is what I did is I dumped Hostile Takeover into a massive Word document and had a little macro that I could type in something and it would just basically print out a paragraph for every appearance of that particular phrase or whatever. So
nice.
So I was, you know, I referenced that planet somewhere. What did I say about it? And I awesome. Type it into the other Word document and I got like a page on, oh, okay, that's what that all was. And
the other
nice thing about it is, and this is actually writer tip for everybody. It's like, I have massive notes, but one of the things you need to, you know, set back and realize is anything that hasn't made it into print is optional. I mean, it's like there are like whole pages of backstory I looked at and said that ain't gonna work.
Right.
I didn't tell anybody about this. I can just change it. So nobody will know.
Right. And you also, you'll sit there and you think, you're thinking, God, this is going to be so cool. I really want to include this in the story. You know, everybody's going to love this. And then you get to a point where you're like, what was I thinking? This is going to be terrible. This is going to ruin five other parts. And then you just change it.
In fact, that's another thing about that, you know, timelines. It's like, the whole pacing and timeline thing, which thank you for admiring. I appreciate that because a lot of work goes into that. But that is primarily a function of revision. It's like, if you look at my first draft, it's like you'd probably be, why is this dragging so much in the middle? And it's really, you have to take a step back and start looking at scenes and start, okay, I need to sort of rank these in terms of their own internal energy and so on. I mean, and that actually, in a multiple viewpoint novel like this, that actually is helpful in organizing that sort of thing, because I can sit back and I can basically, you know, like with a deck of cards, it's like I can just shuffle the points of view until I get like the kind of dramatic upward slope that I want.
Sure.
Well, I think all that hard work shows. I think it was a fantastic read.
And you know, obviously, we're talking about Apotheosis, and there's three books, two that are out, one that's forthcoming. The first one is Prophets. The second one is Heretics. The third one is Messiah. And just for our listeners, I mean, these, you know, if you talk about, and essentially space opera, I in my brain is like epic science fiction. You know, it's just like there's epic fantasy, but this is not a huge, massive, you know, 1,000-page book to read. This is what, like 350 pages. So it's, although it's filled with a lot of stuff and it's, you know, it's got a lot of stuff going on, it doesn't feel like, you know, this huge, dense, mega, epic space
opera.
None of it
doesn't feel padded at all. You said it was 350 pages?
I think so.
It felt like the pages were holding a lot of text. So I don't know if they use a smaller font, maybe, but it just seemed like there was a lot. There was, maybe it was just the content. There's so much going on, and it never dragged. It wasn't padded. Really, I think, well crafted.
Yeah, there's a lot of cutting involved too.
So sure. When does Messiah come out? When is that hitting the bookshelves?
That's February 1st.
Okay. Do you have anything else coming out that you want to talk about or tell people about?
Well, actually, at the moment, I'm sort of in a bit of an authorial limbo because I haven't sold my next project to anybody. I am working on a number of things. I have a sort of interesting take on urban fantasy I'm trying to sell, which my elevator pitch for that one is sort of, if you picture the Zelazny's Amber Chronicles made in an urban fantasy and threw in zeppelins and zombies.
Nice.
It'd be close. since I didn't have a contract and I didn't have any obligations hanging over my head, I just did Nat MoRiMo for the first time.
Oh, nice! Did you win?
Yeah, I got my 50,000 words in. Yeah.
Very cool.
And sort of side effect of being a professional, it's like I work a day job, so I'm sort of calibrating things. So it's like I did exactly the amount I needed to do by the deadline because I had so many other obligations.
Awesome.
And that's sort of YA ghost story, and that was an interesting experiment because I based that solely on an idea I had driving home from World Fantasy. So it was basically me driving home from World Fantasy. I got an idea and I decided, okay, I'm going to see if I'm going to sit down and write. And I didn't have any sort of outline or planning or any sort of concept of this thing before October 31st. Went through a life, which is why I think it took a rather weird left turn from where I was planning on and ended up being sort of a borderline pseudo-mythos story. So
I think there were a lot of people who left World Fantasy and went home and started writing. I think that has that effect.
That kind of does that to you.
Yes.
It's like being immersed in that kind of environment for, you know, with so many, you know, creative people. I mean, there's just the density of authors on the ground there is probably, I think they're probably more professionals there than just straight up fans. And even the fans are professionals in the field. I mean, it's like if you're talking to somebody at World Fantasy and they're not an author, they're probably, you know, they're probably either organizing conventions themselves or, you know, have podcasts or, you know, are doing something else professionally related to the field.
Right. Or they went to high school with someone who was professionally in the field. I'm teasing John slightly. Okay, so where can people find you on the web? Are you doing Twitter? Do you have a blog? Are you doing Facebook?
Yes. The quickest way to do any of that is you go to www.sandrewswan.com. That should be easy to remember.
Okay.
That goes to my blog. My blog, down in the lower right, you will find the little socially networked links, and that will give you the links to my Twitter, my Facebook, anything else I might be doing.
Awesome.
On some sort of semi-regular basis.
Do you have
Follow me on Twitter? It's at @sandrewswan.
Obviously you have books in print. Do you have anything in Kindle or ebook?
Most of the recent stuff is available in some sort of electronic format. It's basically my backlist, probably back to Prophets, plus a few things here and there are available on Kindle and other e-formats.
Awesome.
In addition, for those of you who like audiobooks, Wolfbreed, which is the medieval werewolf book I was talking about, which came out a year and a half ago, that's available as an audiobook. Its sequel, Wolf's Cross, will also be available as an audiobook, and also all three of the Apotheosis series is going to be available as an audiobook. All of that is on Audible.
Oh, very cool.
.com.
Awesome.
And also, if you want to buy my books online, you go to my site, you click on one of the links to my books. I try to make it very easy to navigate. There's just a sheet of book covers. You click on a book cover, you go to a page, and you can find links there to buy it from Barnes & Noble, from Amazon, from IndieBound. You know, if there's an audiobook, you can buy it from there. So
very cool.
I try to make it very easy for people.
That's awesome.
I like it when they buy my stuff.
That's awesome. John, you have any finishing questions, follow-up questions?
That was it. Just a comment that I'm eagerly awaiting this third book. And chomping at the bit.
Very
Looking
cool.
Forward
well,
to it.
Stephen, thank you for joining us tonight. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. I always enjoy the ability to talk about my stuff.
Very cool.
Thanks a lot, Stephen.
Oh, you're welcome.
Did you know we have a voicemail line, 720-277-9082. You should use it. Give us a call. Tell us what you think about the whole Huckleberry Finn thing, or if you have any thoughts on our interview with S. Andrew Swan. That's what the voicemail line's there for. Give us a call. Maybe we'll use it in an upcoming show.